The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me on this very cold December 7th, 2013. It is the 72nd anniversary of Pearl Harbor. December 7th is one of those dates that ring in your mind when you hear it. You know it's something. Oh yes, Pearl Harbor, the day that will live in infamy. It was the way Roosevelt found to get to the American people, or to get the American people to accept war in Europe. He had to start with Japan. He had been working on it for some time, as we know, and was not having enough success. I'm waiting to see if my sound level will finally go up. This is getting very irritating. All right, there. Seems to be better now. He had to start with Japan. Roosevelt did. And one lesson, the funny thing is that there's no news on Pearl Harbor today. I guess, there's various reasons I will quickly look at. It's that it used to be quite make a big splash, you know, in the news and so on. And it was just amazing to me. I'm looking even this morning, even just an hour ago, or so, at U.S. News, on Yahoo News, and there's one little story of survivors, you know, the real old guys, in Hawaii, having a little ceremony, and that's it. And everything is about the cold weather. It's about other stories, Hillary and Biden, and what Obama is saying about them, and all that stuff, and that's it on Pearl Harbor. Now, very likely, it is because the truth has come out about Pearl Harbor, and this is what's interesting to me, is that even though all the documents have been publicized to reveal that Roosie, I like to call him that, a friend. Fellow who used to do some shows with me, not a fellow, a very distinguished scholar, Wesserly, professor, and Professor Wesserly, always called him Roosie. I got that from him. He didn't have any respect for Roosevelt, for sure. Roosevelt's government had driven Japan to take the measures it did, and even supplied the ships that were going to be struck. They made sure that they had ships there that they felt could be lost, because they weren't the newest, and they weren't the most strategically useful. And so all of that was set up, and it wasn't, though, a psyop, ladies and gentlemen, because they just, as I said, drove Japan to do what it did, because it didn't really have any choice any longer. Very much like they drove Adolf Hitler to have no choice but to invade Poland in September 1939. And the same thing happened with Japan. Whenever that was, 7th, what date was that? 1941. To do that. So, but even though all of this has been brought forward, it is never ever mentioned, of course, in mainstream news, in the Jew news. But it doesn't change how we as a nation view this day, although it's not celebrated like it used to be. But it's still seen as the Japanese committed a very dastardly act, and we had to declare war, and so on and so forth. And what it tells me, something I've talked about, I talk about fairly often, that truth has no power. Only very slowly does the truth spread around. It takes so long because it's suppressed with every communication outlet except things like our this alternative movement on the basically on the internet, and no one really cares about it enough to even people who learn about it. Well, do I go out and start, you know, making a bunch of noise and where I live and saying Pearl Harbor was a was fake, you know, and this and that? No, I mean, it's too difficult, and nobody will care to even pay any attention to you if just in a regular community. So, but this is the case though, that at least a lot of people are knowing this, but it's like I say, it's very slow. Now the problem. I was going to talk today. I'm not going to say that anything more about Pearl Harbor, but I did want to recognize that today is the anniversary, and it is the 72nd anniversary, but there really is nothing more to say about it. I titled my program The Problem with Nice. And this is something that came to me real easily because I've held this view of that for quite a long time. I'm not so cynical about it. I'm not cynical, but I do think that nice is overrated and is one of the most useless things. Although sometimes it's okay, you know. I mean, there's other words that could be used, and actually other emotions or other attitudes that might be better, might be expressed better with a different word than nice, because I just want to point out that people learn to be nice so others will be nice to them. This is generally why nice people are as nice as they are, and it is mostly a fear-based motive. The nicest people are those who can't bear to have anyone be unkind to them, or, you know, to say mean things to or about them, and especially to exclude them. That people are very dependent on acceptance in a group, and that's just natural. There's nothing wrong with that. We all share that. But if the feeling of horror, you know, in contemplating such things is strong enough in people, people will make a point to always be nice so that they won't have to deal with unniceness. Now, I have some of these things are kind of hard to say, but I just happen to be a courageous person. I have always had probably more willing to go out on things, to go out on limbs or to go out to do things that other people wouldn't do, then maybe is good for me, because I certainly, then you have a reaction and then you have to respond to the reaction and so on. But one thing it's done for me is made me not afraid of that, and made me very tough, I think, pretty tough, without making me cynical or cruel. But most people, the average person is not ever, doesn't have that and is not going to, take a chance on, and they stay in the area of being nice to one another and being nice is good. It feels good, but what happens on the downside of it is that things go on and people things are not examined as they should, and nobody will say what needs to be said, and so things, you know, just continues along on this kind of a level, and we don't improve, we don't make corrections and changes the way that we should. And just to give a little bit about human nature, you know, I mean, it's been said by so many people, in wise people, that in general, people fall for anything. People love, it's true. If you look at how things, who is successful and who is not, people love to follow scoundrels. They will follow liars and also dummies. The less credible people are, the more others like them. It has to do with maybe not being threatened by somebody who's too superior over you, or the scoundrels and liars are not always so much scoundrels and liars, but, well, sometimes they are. Yeah, people will tend to believe what these people say. They believe what you think that we would see. And I've certainly done plenty of that in my younger days. But you would think that it would be so easy to see through things. And when you get some time away from it, and after you've experienced, you know, being taken advantage of by these scoundrels and these liars, then you can see it clearly. But at the time, you're under some kind of a spell. I don't know what it is, and you don't see it. You know, Barnum and Bailey, the motto, the great theme of theirs is "a sucker is born every minute." I guess Bailey said that, and it was quoted from him. And he's the circus guy, Barnum and Bailey Circus. And they, you know, at circuses and also at carnivals, wow, they go out into the bush, you know, out to the hick towns and so on, and all these people are not used to this kind of, you know, the type of entertainment, and they believe all these things that are being promised, and then they get, you know, they just lose a little bit of money, that's all, at the carnival or whatever. But also, they pull people into these circuses by promising they're going to see all kinds of things. And when you're in there, it's not like they say it's going to be. That's just the typical thing that we have now. We have advertising. I mean, we have much more sophisticated understanding of all this, and yet people, it's still going on. People are still falling for all this. Carlos Porter has a statement on one of his pages that I was reading the other day, and he said, I don't have it here exactly, but he said, in essence, two-legged animals will believe anything. And he said the more incredible or unbelievable, the more they'll believe it. And in general, people don't realize when they're being taken in. And this is what we call gullibility. And we have all been accused, and our Aryan race has been accused of gullibility, and we have certainly expressed that. We are very guilty of that. And con men know that they can count on our gullibility. It takes probably a lot of being taken for a ride because of your gullibility to really learn how not to be, you know, because it's not something you can teach someone. So people will also want to follow the crowd. That's another failing that we have, or just something that can be used against us. And once popularity of a certain group or person or organization or whatever can be shown, the more people want to go there. If it's said that a movie has made a big first opening, you know, and they had so many people going to see it, then everybody decides they want to see it too. And that's just one example. It could be made in every area of life that we do tend to follow the crowd. What about Facebook? How did Facebook get to be the huge thing that it is? Well, they knew how to set it up for what people like. And then as more and more people went there, well, everybody felt they had to be there too. And that's the way it goes. And this is just not people necessarily who are wanting to advertise themselves or advertise their goods or advertise their website and things like that and their ideas, but just ordinary people who once they see everybody talking about Facebook, and they have to go there too. So we do go along in these, if someone can convince people that they are popular and that a lot of people like what they're doing, then other people will join in and they'll actually like it for that very reason, because they think other people are liking it. I want to talk for just a second about how my feelings work. You know, I'm going to go right into now the thing with between John Friend and I. And I'm going to go to, I have to look at his blog post here and to do it, because I didn't copy any of it down. I have, in case you don't know, which I'm, for anybody who would be listening later to the download, I did a program on, what is today, say, on Monday, and I did the first half on Mark Weber and the second half on John Friend. Well, maybe I better say why I did that. It wasn't because of the debate. It was before that I decided I was going to finally decide what I should say about John Friend, because I had, as I said on Monday's program, I had, you know, a lot of problems with my attitude toward and my feelings toward John Friend for quite a long time, and whatever a long time would be, I guess it would be this whole entire year of 2013, just about close to it. And when I it was a program before the program that Mike Delaney and Scott Roberts did by themselves before they had the debate program. That led to the debate program. They were talking about things, and they were to talk a little bit about John and his interest and his fascination with the no planes thing and so on. So after that came the debate program, and then after that came this more recent radio program with Mike, Scott, and Andrew Anglin added in. And then it got to a high pitch. After the debate program, of course, John Friend got on his blog and kind of attacked Mike Delaney and not mostly, and then also Scott, and I think he included Andrew in there, because Andrew had written a blog, that's right, on the Daily Stormer the next day when he posted the radio program there. So, but when I made my decision was the program between Mike and Scott before the debate program. And then when I heard they were going to do this debate, I thought, well, how interesting. That's going to be good. And I listened to it, and I was already working on my side of things. In fact, after that first program, I Skyped, I was between Mike and Scott, I Skyped Mike, and it wasn't while I was listening to it, but I wasn't listening to it live. I listened to it a few days after they did it, after their live show. I Skyped him and told him what I thought about John, and he Skyped me back and said, and I think that's the first time I've ever Skyped him. I had to ask him to be a contact with me, because I've never had him as a Skype contact, and he didn't respond to that. So, he Skyped back. He says it's pretty funny, but you know, we're about coming to that same conclusion here. He said that he was going to be having this debate with John. He hoped I would like it if I would call in. Well, I said I probably wouldn't call in. I just, you know, not needed to add my two cents to it, but I'd listen to it. And so then I decided I needed to put my thoughts into my program, which I'm doing today too, rather than writing some long thing. Now, if you write, you can, as John has done. He's not going to go into this on his program unless he's got a friend there who will do it with him and back him up. Otherwise, he will write about it where he has all the ability to control what he says and correct it and get it just right, and then he'll post it. But he won't just talk about things. A lot of people, most people cannot do a show by themselves without a guest in the way that I do them. I didn't say everybody can't, but a lot of people can't. It's very intimidating, I can tell you. So that's why I did this. And so after that, I want to say, and I'm taking too long here, that why people say, how can you have come up with all this stuff about John? You don't even know these things to be true. And I want to explain how my feelings work and how I trust myself. Because I'm a person with a very clear, intuitive, it's not even intuition, it's an inner voice. It's a feeling too, and the feeling is more trustworthy than any kind of voice, but a type of a voice, not a voice, but words sometimes it accompanies the feeling. But the feeling is something that doesn't come and go. It's there, you know. And I have learned over my life, and I have lived a long life already. And I can tell you, I'm not over yet. I'm not done yet. I'm a long liver. I've been a slow ager. I wish I had known when I was younger that I was going to be such a slow ager. I would have not been in such a hurry. I would have done things a little differently, maybe. Wouldn't have thought I was going to be old long before I actually did become old. I'm basically old now, but I've still got a lot in me and a ways to go. So, but therefore, in this life of mine, I have always had this inner communication coming through to me. And I have spent a lot of my life in spiritual work and actually thinking that was the only thing really worthwhile at times, the only thing I cared about. The other thing I cared about was art. And I never thought I would be doing what I'm doing now during most of my lifetime. I didn't think this is how I was going to, you know, do my golden years, you might say, you know, when I was retired, I could do what I wanted. But it's because of what I've learned about Germany and finally getting in touch with that. I've talked about this before. I'm not going to go into this. But, you know, I am now quite devoted. And it's probably the Internet, too. I mean, computer, getting on a computer and getting in the Internet. It moved me into this direction. And I'm quite happy, and I'm totally caught up in it. So, but I was saying that my spiritual connection, yeah. So I have these, I just have an open, it's, you know, the way I see it, it's just maybe the between my inner and outer personalities, there isn't more openness than some people have. And I have always gotten this feeling about things at times, and it is something that is often non-intuitive, counterintuitive, so that I don't really think I should follow it. You know, I'll have it. It'll be real clear when it comes to me that something is wrong or something is right. You know, I just immediately I feel real good about something or I feel bad about something. Sometimes it's just that. And it's a strong warning and message that this is something that's good for me or this is something that's not good for me. And if it's not, what I believe about when it's not good for me, it's because it is, reverberate. That's not the right word. It doesn't, it's not in tune with who I am and what I am and what my goals are and what I like and what my motives are and so on. It's counter to what I am about. And so, I have found to my dismay many times that this, when I deny this and say, well, you don't have any evidence for this. You don't know this. You have no, basis. And the world is telling me something different. You know, I've had this a lot. Actually, I got into, investment with my own money that I earned, and I'm not afraid of risk, obviously. So I started doing this, thinking, "Well, this is the thing to do. I better do it." And so I have these feelings to do this or do that, and I would never ever listen to myself because I thought, "Well, you don't know," and I'm reading the news and I'm reading the financial pages and so on, and they're saying this and that, and so then, you know, I'm doing too much of that, and I go against that real simple. It's not like somebody, you know, it's not like it's hitting me over the head. It's very subtle. It's very subtle. So, but it's very identifiable too. If I would ever have trusted it enough, but I didn't. So I've learned though. Every time it was amazing. It was amazing. The money I denied myself by not following these feelings I get. Then slowly, I have learned to trust this. But it's easier when there's not really anything material at stake. I will say that. And so when I get this feeling about people, and I remember sometimes getting, once I got a very strong negative feeling about somebody, the minute he walked into the room and looked at me, and I could see he was interested in me, and my feeling came up so strong that he was really an evil person. Well, he turned out to be evil for me. He might not have been actually an evil person, but, and then later I let myself, relax with him, and I thought he was such a nice person. Well, anyway, like 2 years later, you know, I'm having to get out of this entanglement with this person. So, and I knew I could always remember that feeling I had, and I just ignored it. And I've ignored this so much in my life. So I do trust it. And that's basically what I've been going on with John Friend, because he had always given me a negative feeling once I got to know him. But there is a little bit more to it than that. So I will say this, that as he has said in his blog, he came up with these emails that I sent, and it shows I don't mind. I don't mind that. I had actually forgotten. First, I need to say, he asked me, or he pointed out that, why did I not mention my first email to him when I invited him on my program on, guess what, January 1st of this year? And my answer is because I absolutely forgot all about it. I absolutely did. And when I was reading this and I'm seeing that it says, she sent me this email about she invited me on a program. I thought, what's he talking about? I didn't invite him on a program. Then I move on, and well, there's that, and then I say, oh yeah, I remember that now. And now a lot of things have come back to my memory that I had forgotten, basically, you know, lost track of over the course. But a year ago, it's funny that he saves emails like this for almost 12 months. Why is he doing that? I don't know. I don't delete emails very quickly, but I don't save something like this, and I don't save them for so long. Eventually, you have to clean out. But obviously, he has a folder on me, and this is in it. So, but that's okay because it shows how I didn't have any, you know, I had only heard him on Carly's show, and I was wanting to do something about Sandy Hook, and I was thinking about who I could get to do it along with me, and I heard that, and I thought, well, he sounds like a nice person, and he sounds like he's really knows something, you know, he's really looked into it, and I was of this, vaguely, I was kind of the same opinion. I thought it was kind of shocking that he, kind of strange, I mean, that he was so certain. He was so certain already that nobody was killed. He was telling Dr. Carly, oh, it's very clear to me. I'm going to say nobody was killed there. Nothing, you know, nothing happened. None of this ever happened. It's all made up. And I couldn't make such a statement myself. I was suspicious. But to say that nothing happened and be so sure about it. So I thought, well, he'd be good to have on and see how he explains that. But he did have something he had to do on Saturday. I think he said that's when he had a daughter, and that's when he had to spend with her or something. And so I suggested we could move it to Monday, to my Monday show. And that's when I found out he had a show of his own on Monday. I didn't know that. And after that, I looked into him more, and I found these guests that he had had, and that he had a show exactly the same time I did, and that he had had Charles Giuliani, and he had had Jim Condit as guests, and that he was, you know, speaking well of Jim Fetzer and all of these things. And that's when my attitude toward him did change, and I thought, what the heck kind of a person is he anyway? I was then so glad, as I found out more, and I was so glad that I didn't, that he wasn't able to come on my show. Because as I, as little time went on, and my feeling about him was pretty darn negative, I really hadn't had much any contact with him, before that. And so since then, as I've read and looked at things, I was going to say, I know people don't like to hear about feelings, but you know, it would always come up just like this person is not on the same page that I'm on, but he talks like he all this time thought he was on the same page I was on. He comments that, somewhere, not here, but that of the people that he looked up to, that must have been, I don't know, that was in that thing over at that thing he wrote that I read just the other day, on End of Zion blog, yeah, where he says the people who he has followed are Deanna Spingola, ZCF, Carolyn Yeager, and, who was the fourth one now? Somebody similar. So, Bill Fink, maybe. Maybe he mentioned him there, maybe not. I've heard him say many times that, he's mentioned me a few times. I do good work, or I'm good at really good about this and that and so on. So anyway, as we go on into these emails, I don't know whether to, let's see. I'll leave this other for last. As we go into these emails, he says, it was this thing about him asking me to call into Condit. I'm not going to go into that too much. He thinks that people will think this is real terrible, and he's got a bunch of commenters who are saying so, you know, oh, it's so despicable what she said to you. Huh. What did I say? You know, I gave my opinion very, very bluntly, like I generally do. And because 2 weeks after 2 weeks after, we both know that he has a show at the same time I do, and it's a live show, that he writes to me and asks if I will suggest I call into his program at that time. I found it irritating. So I said so. I meant this as to for him to think about what he's doing, you know. I mean, how could I call into your program when I have a program of my own? It's like, you know, it's like he's in his own little world there, and that's all that exists. And then I made some other comments that I thought, why not, you know? And I don't see anything wrong with them. A lot of people do because of what I said about Truth Militia. But you know, Truth Militia came on, and they came on real, in my opinion, as a rather sleazy program. And then John got a show with them, while he says that he doesn't really agree with everything they do and so on. And all of these guests of his and all of these people, he says, well, I don't agree with them about a lot of what they say, which is pretty basic stuff that he doesn't agree with, but he wants to have them on anyway. I cannot make sense out of that. And at the time, I just didn't want to have anything to do with them. But as time has gone on and more things have been revealed, you have to wonder why he was always doing this, why he was always associating and linking to or having guests and this and that with people who were inappropriate for, according to his beliefs that he is professing, for him to have, and yet he has them and links to them and so on anyway. So I think that these emails show that I did go back and forth with him a few times and I did let him know what I thought, and every time things just deflect off of him. No matter what you say to him, he's like, well, this doesn't apply to me. You know, I'm not this way. You know, I just like listening to people. He says, I've been on Charlie's show and he came on mine, and he doesn't like the way fascist Christianity, but he still enjoys listening to him. That's such an essential thing there, that I don't know how he could still enjoy listening to him. So these were all things that just kept making me feel that he was a questionable character. And then, of course, he says, I'm done with this email thread. Well, I hadn't intended to say any more, but some people like to do that. They like to make out that that they're cutting you off as though you're trying to continue with them. You know, another person who did that was Mark Glenn, who kept emailing me, and I answered him a couple of times, but briefly. His were long, and then, although mine were a little longer here, but, and then he says, well, I'm done with all this. And then he's got that, you know, in his files that, So, all right, going on, back up about these pictures. John says, he picks out from my show what he wants to respond to. And he does a pretty good movement, a pretty good job, but one thing he left out was my criticism of him saying everything is not everything, but my criticism of him connecting 9/11 and the Holocaust as psyops. And he doesn't mention that. He doesn't go into that because he's only looking for things that he can pick out that he can reveal about my character, and that I'm a despicable person. And I want to point out that he did that in this previous post that included me, sort of, along with Mike Scott and Andrew, that we were all despicable for criticizing him, that we had done it in a despicable manner, we were attacking him and all for no reason, and yet people have been dealing with him all this year, all I have been this year, observing him, watching him, and seeing what's going on, And yet all he can say, he can't answer anything. He doesn't try to answer anything. He just wants to label you a despicable person. And then he tries to prove it by the way he describes what you have said about him or to him. This reaction, to my mind, is Jewish. You know, this is exactly what Jews do when they have to deal with criticism. They will not accept any criticism. None of it is correct. You know, none of it really applies to them. Therefore, it's anti-Semitism. And what John is doing is saying, you know, whatever criticism you have of me, it's because you're a despicable person. And I don't want to have anything to do with you because I'm innocent of everything. I've never done anything. And he is able to, just like they do, just fling away all these things that he does, all these connections with Jews, all these connections with non-whites, all of these very questionable guests he has and so on. And he just makes out like, well, I agree with some of the things they say. I don't agree with everything. As though that's an answer for it. For somebody who certainly is trying to make himself a name in this movement, he can deny that all he wants. But one thing I've noticed with John all through this year is that he posts comments everywhere, you know, and that are don't say much, but every time you post a comment on various blogs and websites, if you have a website of your own, you can put, you know, make your name links to your website. And then it brings, people can say, oh, John Friend. And if people don't know him, and they might think, Friend, what kind of, that's, if people are attracted to a name like that, that's why Jews use that name, Friend. I wonder what kind of person John Friend is. You don't hear about too many people named with that name like that. And they click on there, and then they see him, and, you know, that's how he gets people to know who he is and to see him as somebody who, a whole lot of people are following him. Look at this, you know. He has removed a lot of stuff from his website, I'll say that. Back then it was dark blue and it was covered, filled with stuff. Now it's very plain and simple. So that, I have that to say. And then I have to say about the comments on his site. I know that he moderates them pretty heavily. He really does. And if you have you have criticisms of him, or if there's too much that's not friendly, he won't post it. I know, because I have written a few comments under anonymous and that were that had a critical tone to them, and none of them were ever posted, were ever published there. And I have to say, now he may have, I have to look to see if he has okayed a whole bunch more comments to this. Takes me a while to get down here. Sorry about that. I don't want to jump down too far and get in the wrong place while I'm scrolling down here. Good grief. 14 now. Well, he just has 14. Last I looked, it was 6. I'm not going to look at them now. Well, maybe I better. Okay, I don't really want to get into comments too soon, but that's not so much. But a lot of his commenters are anonymous. Most of the people who write on there, look at all these. They're anonymous. I think, because I read some of them last night, I think that I suspect that some of these anonymous people are the same person. They're the same person writing because they sound the same. And they're just writing the same kind of things to help John out, you know. And then there's ones when they say, and there's Matt Parrott, just looking for an opportunity to to get back at Carolyn. But, you know, he's talking about how terrible it is to talk about his looks, you know, and, I called him a fat Jew, who looked like he should be living in Tel Aviv. Now, of course, and some of these commenters said that too, and I never said it that way. You can always take things and put them in a different way. I said that he looked in these pictures and he does like to show pictures of himself. He obviously thinks he's very handsome. But you could also say, well, he's showing who he is. He's not afraid. No, he's not. No, he likes to show who he is. He likes to get a lot of attention. He likes to be right there in the middle of everything. So that could be looked at in two different ways. He's bold and courageous, or he's overdoing it and he's not afraid of anything because he's on the other side. I know that's hard to believe, and I'm not saying that I believe it. I mean, I don't believe it. I don't not believe it. I'm on the fence. I don't know. But the more you can get him to react to things, the more you learn about it. And in this second picture he has here on this blog, on his latest blog here, blog post, he does look quite heavy. He really does. The one where he's seated, pictures I had seen of him before, he looked, you know, very young and slender to me. You know, one of that slenderness that youthful people have. And he admits he's gained 10 pounds. I guess 10 pounds can make quite a difference. Probably in the last, and he says since high school, but I bet it's been more recently because he just looks much more heavy. And I thought that in that second picture, where his features before had seemed kind of finer, you know, it had that younger quality to him, younger look. Now this time, and the photographs do show things differently, but, you know, I mean, you can, photographs can be very different one from another on the same day, but they do show a kind of a, to me, the word I would have used if I had thought of it would be coarsening, a coarsening of his features. They're not as delicate, as fine and Aryan looking as I thought. I'm not saying, I don't know what he looks like, and I don't, he could be 100% German Aryan, you know, I mean, we look all different kind of ways. I know that. I'm saying that there's no reason. He looks like he's in Tel Aviv in that picture to me. That's what strikes me. And look at those knees, those legs. I mean, this guy is kind of he's not, so that's all I was saying. I never said that he was fat, and yet everybody keeps repeating that, do I look like a fat Jew? No, I never said that he was fat. Okay, let me move along here. My points, all right. So, you know, speaking about calling everything a psyop, and it's gotten to be kind of popular. That with people now. And, I would agree, you know, I use the word psyop for, Sandy Hook. Now, I don't know if I might revise some of my opinions now, but that was back in January. I did study Sandy Hook, but with those people who believed it was all fake, like at September Clues. And, you know, they could put on a pretty convincing, argument there, because they use all these photographs and they're so clear, you know, and you have to kind of wonder. Now I'm wondering now. I already wondered about that place, September Forum. I mean, Clues Forum, Simon Shack's thing. Yeah, I was looking there now, enjoying that and trying to learn something about it. But if you go back and he wants to call the Hola hoax a psyop and say that was the progenitor of 9/11. And that sounds very, you know, appealing to a lot of people. But you really cannot, you can call parts of the Holocaust story today, the narrative and all the not just the narrative, but the way the propaganda about it, the way it's being presented and so on. You can call all that, you can call those PSYOP, but they're all individual ones. It's not one big PSYOP where it was planned ahead of time and then it was carried out, you know, in a fake way and not really happening or only partially happening. And then it's not like that at all. And when you try to compare the two that way, you're going to screw up what people think about the Holocaust. That's what I'm concerned about. That's what I'm worried about. That this is some underhanded way to do damage to Holocaust revisionism and our real efforts there. And if you go back in history and you look at all the events that triggered, the small events that triggered much bigger disastrous events, there's all kinds of them. Just, you can even go back to what started World War I, and there was that assassination of Ferdinand, the heir to the throne of Austria. Who was behind that? Well, we know it was communists, but was there a bigger mind behind it, or just these rebellious communists from Serbia? What was it? I mean, there's any number of things. Oh, so was that a PSYOP? I would say no, that was not a PSYOP, even if something was behind it. You have to be careful with this, and I don't think he's being careful. And not only do I think he's not ever being careful enough, but I don't think he knows enough. And he could just be, you know, dense or jumping the gun without having enough background knowledge. Or he could be trying to do something, you know. He could be part of the disinformation and misinformation scene. In what way and working for who, I do not know. I do know that Deanna Spingola had told me just the other day, and as far as I know, she talks about this in her chat room. She's not somebody who will talk about it on a program. She's not somebody who will come out public, but she'll tell people privately that she thinks he's a Jew. I don't say he's a Jew. I just say I kind of, you know, he could be. But she says he is a Jew, and he's and Fetzer is a CIA agent, and Fetzer is John Friend's handler. Yeah, and she says that. She said she told her chat room, not too long ago, spoke in her chat room and said, somebody was asking when John Friend, got started, how he got to, you know, be so well known. And she said, I told them, I wrote, that John Friend slithered into the truth movement or the alternative truth movement in early 2012. That's what she, or was it late 2012 maybe, but that's what she said to me. So, if you want to attack Carolyn for saying out loud what other people are saying but are afraid to say out loud, then okay, because I don't mind being attacked for things that I believe in and that I think I'm speaking the truth. And to say that I'm doing it, it's overdone to say that I'm doing it in some kind of a hateful, hateful way. I don't think that was hateful, except to talk about him, how he, that he looks Jewish in these pictures to me, or he could be, you know, he looks like he's, and I wasn't calling him fat either. I already went into that. All right. Now, I brought up, and I want to bring up here, look, I've run out of time, John Friend wrote this review on Veronica Clark's book, her book on Hitler and Himmler, Uncensored, which I'm going to talk about in the second hour. And he said, and I brought that up, and he thought it was just, well, what was wrong with me, with him, right? He didn't have anything. I was trying to connect him with Veronica Clark, who is now coming out and saying that she hates she's not, she hates white nationalists. That's okay. But she's not a national socialist, now she's saying. She's not a national socialist. Pretty strange. But John, earlier in the year, this year, I think in May 2000, oh no, a year and a half ago, May 2012, he bought that book, obviously, and he wrote this review. And what I want to say is that it's not really a review. You know, it's one of these Amazon reviews where you kind of promote a book or you do the opposite to a book. That's what these things mostly are for. And he said, I cannot recommend this book highly enough. It may be the most profound book I have ever read, especially Hitler's speech at Flatterhof, which comprises most of chapter 3. But then he doesn't tell us anything about the book, why he thinks it's so profound, or what kind of point Veronica Clark was making. He goes into his usual spiel about, you know, how National Socialist Germany is the most demonized state in the, you know, that ever was, and Hitler, and people need to learn the truth and so on. But nothing, nothing really that helps you to understand what's in the book. It makes you wonder if you ever read it, but I believe he did. And, it's this kind of thing. To me, whenever he writes and talks about anything, it's just like this. He never really says anything. Yeah, when he gets into 9/11, how it happened and so on, he can do that. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to our break. I hope you stick around for the second half. It's going to be pretty interesting. So I'll see you then.
Keiner, der an dich denkt, nur eine einzige Zahl erinnert an deine Qual. Keiner kommt mehr hierher, niemand vermisst dich mehr. Oh, es tut weh, wenn ich deinen Stein so sehe. Treuer Soldat, mehr als ein namenloses Grab. Ich höre die Stimme, ich höre zum Gespräch. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Es ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich schwöre dir, so wahr ich hier stehe, ich trage die Fahne, wohin ich auch gehe. Nie werde ich euch verraten. Für kein Geld der Welt, ich kämpfe für dich, ungebrochener Held, ich kämpfe für dich, unbekannter Held. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich gedanke zu mir sprich, du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben, nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Und wer dann auch lügt, euer Namen benutzt, eure Heldentaten durch Geld hier beschmutzt, den trifft das Schwert von unsichtbarer Hand, ein Totenwächter. Von Wotan gesandt, ein Totenwächter im schwarzen Gewand. Doch ich höre eine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Es ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein, egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Kamerad, du siehst, wir stehen für euch ein, die Kraft, die wir brauchen, wird uns Wotan verleihen. Ihr gabt so viel für dieses Land, es war der Glaube, der euch verband, es war der Glaube. Der euch verbannt. Doch ich deine Stimme. Ich stoppe zum Gespräch. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Und kehre ich einst an deinen Stein zurück, berichte ich dir von unserem Glück. Dann ist es geschafft und wir sind wieder frei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, darum ging's mir dabei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, denn jetzt sind wir frei. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich höre eine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Und bis an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Halt. Wir sind Geiste, die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Says recording, but my sound level is not moving. You know, I'm having some computer problem. I have my SkyCon page on, but it doesn't look like it's acting right. And I'm not sure if I'm going out now. It's connecting and it's like it's disconnected. I'm a little bit concerned. I know that Tan Stoffel is not around. And I would like someone to try to call me if you are hearing me. But I have this feeling that you're not. And I need to, I might need to hang up and reconnect. So looks like I need to do that. If somebody would let me know or send me a Skype message, anybody who's listening that has can send me a Skype message, please send me a message and on Skype and let me know right now if I need to hang up and reconnect for this program. It looks like I got disconnected from SkyCon. Okay, I'm looking at an old page. All right, I am going to hang up. Nobody's hearing me, so that's what I'll do. Well, I'm here on I'm here on Skype, but it looks like nothing's happening. No, I can't connect to SkyCon for some reason. So I have to shut down. Looks like I don't know if. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, my SkyCon is not working, but Paul Hickman sent me a message and said that I sounded fine. Although I can't get a SkyCon page at all. He says I can't even get the page up, so I can't answer the call. Maybe I can answer the call. Let's see. Incoming call. Let me see here. Whoops. No. I forget what I do here. Oh, yeah. 31787. It looks like who's on the line?
Well, this is Mary from North Las Vegas, Nevada.
Hi, Mary.
I'm calling to let you know that I hear you just fine on the White Network.
Well, thank you very much. You know, something I've never had this happen. My SkyCon page, which shows me what's going on the show, just I can't even connect to it. It's gone, and so I figured I couldn't. You know, everything was dead, but. Paul Hickman also sent me a Skype message saying that they could hear me fine. So I appreciate that very much. So I will just continue then, Mary. Did you have any other comment you would like to make?
Well, I love your show, and I listen to all of your broadcasts on the White Network, and I agree with everything you say.
Wow.
About white nationalism and our people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very...
Go ahead.
I'm very concerned about what is going on in this country right now, especially in regard to white people and our traditions and our culture. And I have to say that I think you're one of the bravest people to speak out the way you do.
Well, thank you. I wonder, this seems to be the thing that people are most concerned with is what's happening to our white people. But at the same time, you know, I like to talk a lot about history and the past. And do you find that those shows don't do as much for you as the ones about...
Oh, no, not at all. I really love the history.
Okay.
I think that we have to study history. And I think getting inspiration from history, especially the history of Germany during the Third Reich, I've been reading up on it. I have a book by Klatschke, I think the author's name is. It's called Look to Germany, and he visited Germany, and they had television back in the 1930s.
Yes, they did.
And they were way ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
And all I want to say is that I am wondering what would happen if Germany had won World War II.
Well, that's a good thing to wonder. I think the answer is pretty clear. We would be none of these horrible things that are happening to us or to other people too would be happening. It would be going on. So, Mary, I want to thank you for your call. I appreciate your input very much. And because I've got a lot here to cover yet, I'm going to go ahead with it then, since you find it of value. Okay?
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And continue the good work.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, sorry, it's my computer, obviously. Some kind of slowdown in my computer, that's the problem. The only thing I was going to, before I get into the Platterhoff speech, I want to say something about what I put in my my announcement for this show, that it's the fallacy of thinking everyone can work together without a leader. And I have so many people saying to me, you know, your criticisms, Carolyn, are too much. And, you know, we need to all work together. And we don't need to be attacking one another. And I find it kind of difficult because to think that way. Because it seems if, you know, on Thursday, Hadding and I were doing the International Jew, and we ended with, you have to look inside, you have to look underneath to see what's really going on and what these Jews are doing, and you have to investigate deeply into things in order to, excuse me, I need some water now, in order to make any changes, make any difference. And I feel that if we let things go by and people are too trusting of one another, and we think that we're all working together, and we're getting somewhere, and we don't get anywhere. We don't get anywhere. And Adolf Hitler's beliefs were absolutely not like that, which I'm going to go into here in a minute. This idea that somehow everybody who calls himself by something, or who has, you know, who has shares some things, or appears to share some things, are working for the same goal, or are working together, because often their immediate goal is very different, and whatever the way that their take on things is going to lead into a different direction. And small differences can make a big difference in the end. And so it's my view that there needs to be some, and I guess you need a strong leader for this, and we don't have it. We don't have one. And everybody knows that. But there has to be a set way goal, and how we're going to get there, and what it takes to get there, and that has to be followed by people. I mean, that has to be agreed to, and there has to, if there's a majority, then at least that many people can be doing it. But I think I absolutely don't believe in this lone wolf thing, because you don't have any idea what people are doing, and not going all together with lone wolf, but just the idea that, well, I'm going to do this, and you're going to do that, and he's going to do that, and she's going to do that, doesn't necessarily get us anywhere. It might be nice, and it entertains people, and there's a lot of entertainment going on, but I am just hoping that that we can criticize one another without getting all bent out of shape over it, even if it takes you by surprise and seems very shocking to you, and people are shocked by it and they hate it. That's what I was talking about, this whole program about being the problem with nice. You know, if we're not capable of having tough enough exteriors to weather the slings and arrows from our brothers and sisters, who supposedly are, then how can we weather that from the enemy? You know, if we're so damn weak. And, you know, I just, more and more, I just have this thing about weakness. I can't stand it. And I can't stand this idea that you can't say anything that's not nice about somebody, and you can't say what you really think, not out loud, or you won't be nice. So enough about the nice right now, so I can get back to give some real examples of this. I have the Platterhoff speech. I read it yesterday, the whole thing. I had not read it before that, because I had not gotten Veronica's book, and I had not been clear what was in her book. But I am also a friend of Wilf Hank, who is supposedly the co-author of that book. I hope he's not going to be upset with what I'm going to say now, because I'm going to, reveal some of the things that he has told me, but I don't think that they're any secret. And I don't, you know, I mean, I don't think they're anything that he feels is secretive or anything. So it's not going to hurt anyone. Wilf has done a lot of translating for Veronica. You know, Veronica Kuznier-Clark has surprised everyone. Didn't surprise me too much, but I am surprised that she has now rejected National Socialism. I can't quite figure that out. But I, as I already said, I can figure out the white nationalism part, because she never was. You know, she never was a white nationalist, and I have known her. I don't know her in a real personal way. I've never met her, but I met her via Fritz Berg quite a number of years ago, and we had some email exchange. He wanted her and I to get together. He thought she had so much potential, and he thought that her affection for black people and so on, she might be able to, maybe I could talk her out of it or something. of course, I wasn't trying to talk her out of it, but we conversed a little bit, you know, and I gave my views and she gave hers, but she was very nice. I liked her, and I had her email for quite a while, and sometimes I used it as far as I know, because finally it didn't work anymore. And then, you know, she had changed it, and then she changed it again. And her story was always that she was being hounded and harassed by, you figured it was by Jews, but because of her websites and her, mostly it was her websites then. She wasn't writing books then. Then she, at some point, she got into putting out all these books, which I'm kind of suspect of, because they're mainly stuff that's been translated. You know, they're not really books she's written. And I started just not liking her multiculturalism. But Wilf Hienck has done more translating for her than anyone else, I think. But she another book she did, it was Hans Krampe. And then she has another one with somebody whose name I forgot, but I don't know him. These books, all of her books, it seems to me, are translations of other people's things that she finds that she thinks is of value, and she turns it into a book with wolves on the cover most of the time. And I never could figure out what she was getting at. And I have one of her books, but I didn't find it interesting. It's the one that Hans Krampe did. His name is on there. Anyway, Wilf tells me that he only translated those speeches for Veronica and translated stuff. And after he translated them, he just sent it to her and didn't have anything more to do with it. And he had nothing to do with putting together this particular Hitler and Himmler book. But she writes in the book that they worked together so closely in getting the translation just right, and it was, you know, she makes a big story out of it that doesn't appear to be the way it really was, and I want to tell you that Wilf was kind enough to tell me today because I asked him, how do you know, what do you feel about the authenticity of this Platterhoff speech, because it's not on the internet, you know, and if there's excerpts of it, and it's like a lost speech. It's like he gave this speech, but nobody has a copy of it unless it's hidden away in some vault somewhere by the Allies or the Russians or whatever. Anyway, he told me that Veronica told him she had found it by discovering a cellar of old documents. I think this is what he means. And he was selling this, and it was very pricey. That's his words. He at that time said, and this was December 6th, I believe it is genuine, and Veronica also believed it was Hitler's most important speech. Then later on, I heard from him this morning, and I was still pressing about certain things about it. And he said, I just remembered that Veronica did send me the 2009 edition, because he said he didn't have the book. He didn't want the book. He had told me that he didn't like the book. He didn't want his name on it like that. I said, but you're the co-author of this book. And and you don't have it. And he said, well, he didn't want it. He didn't want to have his name on there like that. He objected to it, to her, but she left it that way anyway. That's how she wanted it to be. And she didn't pay attention to his objections, and he's irritated about it. He says he doesn't really believe in he doesn't agree with so much in that book, and he doesn't want he doesn't want it that way, but he couldn't do anything about it. He's not the kind of person to get angry. I mean, he's still on friendly terms with Veronica, but he told me that she has disappeared, you know, and but he sent her an email yesterday and she replied to it. So she's not that disappeared, but she has done these things before. I mean, she comes and goes, you know, and she's always got some story, but I don't want to get into her like that right now, because she has taught a lot of people a lot of things in her programs with Deanna Spingola, but otherwise these books are something kind of different than that. Than those issues, that those subjects she talks about on the Spingola show. But he said that he found the book. He did have it. Of course, she sent him one. But he had forgotten all about it. He said he'd never read it. But then he said, I now remember that I also had misgivings about this speech. So first he said that, you know, he thought it was genuine and Veronica believed in it. But then the next morning he had thought more about it. You know, that's how it was. That's how it is. With these things, you comes back slowly, like me and sending that email January 1st to John Friend asking him to be on my program, to be a guest. You know, I'd totally forgotten it. But so he has misgivings about the speech. Well, he's not the expert anyway. Who is, you know? And that's just his opinion. But he is he's the one who translated it. And he sent me his translation, and it's a very interesting speech. And I was going to address the issue of how significant is it. Well, I was trying to get what Veronica actually thought about it. And one thing Wilf said, he said he was, you know, he was trying to help the cause by translating for her. And then he said her racial nonsense irked me, however, because he is not a multiculturalist. He is not, you know, he believes, he's not a white nationalist, but he probably basically believes the same thing, but might not want to be, you know, like the way they go about it or something. But, but he understands the importance of these racial issues, and he also would like to see Germany be all German and be the way it used to be. Maybe before national, you know, at some better stage than what it was under Hitler. He kind of gets back and forth about Hitler. He's not sure, but he says that Veronica tried to demonstrate that the National Socialists were not racist. That's the way he puts it. What she was trying to do, and that's how I saw it all the time, she was trying to show National Socialism as not being racist. And maybe at this point she has decided that all her efforts were in vain, that maybe the National Socialists cannot be turned into non-racist, and so now she's not a National Socialist anymore. That's the way I put it together. In any event, to this Platterhoff speech, we have to even question whether this is legitimate, whether he made this speech, or if this is the way it was. It was taken down by a stenographer, and that's the copy that Wilf worked from was that way, and he had trouble making out some of it. He said some of it was illegible, some of it didn't make sense, but most of it did, you know. I mean, it's just in certain places he would say, well, this is, I'm not sure about this. This is the best I can make out of it. or I can't make anything out of it, and things like that. Or there's certain areas that where the writing was just illegible, or, you know, over a period of time, it just faded away, maybe. But this speech, I don't know what Veronica was trying to prove by it, but she did make a comment in her introduction to it, which I was able to see part of her introduction to it. I don't have that book, and it was $45, I thought, for a book under 200 pages, and, I wasn't about to pay that, and I wasn't sure I needed that book or, you know, cared about it, but now I'd like to see the whole book. But anyway, I've got certain things to go by. And she did write in her introduction to Hitler's speech, and it was not, John Friend called it a short introduction, a brief introduction. So I guess, there wasn't much, a whole lot more than what I saw, but she made the point that Hitler, if he had known that the Soviets were going to be so strong and that he was going to end up facing what he did face, that he would not have invaded, he would not have gone into the Soviet Union with Operation Barbarossa. And she bases that on the conversation he had that's fairly well known with the Finnish either president or prime minister, and I can't think of his name, Meinerhof or Meinerhaven or something. Maybe that's wrong. But that Finnish, that famous conversation where he was actually recorded audio of him speaking, and the only recorded audio of him speaking in a normal tone of voice that exists. You know, everything else is in speeches. And giving a speech, he was a lot more, you know, dramatic and loud and so on than in his normal conversation. So it's famous, that conversation, for that reason. And he expresses to this Finnish leader that he had no idea. He would have thought, I think he said something like, I would have had to think more about it. I might not have done it but I don't think that you can say, you know, if he knew that they had all these tanks and planes back in the interior of the Soviet Union, all these industrial plants and so on, in the middle and eastern part, that they could turn out all these tanks and planes at the speed that they did. He had no idea of that. And so when he went into there, he didn't think they were going to be faced with that as in a year's time or so. But I don't think that you could say, as she did, oh, absolutely, he would never have done it had he known, because he had to do it. I mean, what choice did he have? He's made that very clear, and many others have seen the truth of that, too, that if he didn't do that, Germany and all Europe were at stake. And so he attacked the best thing he could ever have done was to make a surprise attack. And he knew that the quality of surprise was what was going to make the difference. And so they did make a very strong beginning. But there was more resistance than he expected. And eventually they got worn down. And the weather didn't cooperate with them either. So that's about all I can say about what Veronica was trying to get at. She may have been trying to say, oh, Hitler was not a warmonger. He hated war. He would not have gone in there against these Russians, because the first part of the book is with this Wehrmacht soldier who is giving who wrote his reminiscence of his time on the Eastern Front, and amongst Russians and so on. And I don't know how, it's fairly long, I guess, but that was also translated. She got hold of that and had that translated, but that was translated by someone else. So, the book is kind of a hodgepodge of things, and I'm not sure what the point is she's trying to make. But her overall point is always that the Germans and Hitler were not racist, and she's trying to to do, you know, undo that, that quality that, that we care about preserving our race, because she obviously doesn't. So on to the speech, how significant. That is definitely, you know, if it's even accurate, if it's even genuine. And then again, what as I read it, the only thing I can find that is that Hitler is trying to communicate with his generals what his whole position is and why it's been the right position, that is his political and ideological position, which takes in the importance of race. And he talks about that too. And I think she wants you to think that he has changed. She has said, and I know. Yeah, and I know. She has always said about this speech that it shows how he changed his mind. Later on in 1944, he didn't have the same racial views as he did earlier. And he didn't have the same, I don't know about the views about Jews, but he would never have done the things. In 1944, he was a different man than he was earlier. And I didn't find any evidence of that at all. Not at all. So I don't know where, that's why I wonder what, if there was anything in her commentary, which was very brief, I understand, in where she was trying to make those points, or if she leaves it to the reader, to somehow come to that conclusion from what she's put together there with Himmler and with Hitler and with some of these other parts of the book. But on page 8, and there's quite a lot, this is not even the Word document page, but on I guess the pages he was working from. So, you know, not at the beginning of the speech, but down a ways. I'm going to quote here from this. If I have accepted a view as being correct, then it is not only my duty to make citizens of a state aware of it, but to eliminate contrary views. Now, this is where he is saying why he wants only one party, only one view, only National Socialism to rule in Germany. He doesn't want a democracy. You know, he doesn't want everybody to have their own opinion and so on. So he goes on, this may sound intolerant, but gentlemen officers, all of life is a continuation of intolerances. Nature teaches that. Nature is intolerant towards all that is not right, weak, primarily against weakness. Let me say that again. Nature is intolerant towards all that is not right. That is not right, that is weak, that is and that nature is primarily against weakness. Nature eliminates all that is weak, starting with primitive life forms. A bitch will push a weak little one away trying to suckle, you know, a little newborn, push it away. Why? We don't know, but she will let it die. We believe this to be cruel, but in reality, it is right. Now, does this sound like he's changed from when he wrote Mein Kampf? Doesn't sound like it to me. Sounds like the very same thing. Excuse me, I'm getting a dry throat. It's very cold here today, and so I have heat on, and heat kind of dries things out. It is madness to believe that political views must be tolerant. Tolerance can only be understood as a sign of insecurity. At the moment when I am certain to have solved a problem, developed a certain view, it becomes not only my right, but my duty to eliminate all other views. There you go. This is what he thinks, that you cannot have a strong nation unless there's, one view that everybody adopts. And you have to not only get people to adopt that view, you have to eliminate the other views so that they're no longer available for people. That's very extreme, and people would have very much of a reaction against that. Almost everybody would, and say, oh, I wouldn't want to live there. you know, and we need tolerance and so on. But, you know, I resonate with this kind of thing, knowing the, now, like the caller we had, Mary, that was excellent, you know, knowing the extreme danger that we're in, knowing the distress that we have come to, and because of this, because of the very things he's saying that he wouldn't allow in Germany when he was the chancellor. So anyway, continuing with him, let me move to the position of an officer. When I state the above as a politician, then I state something that must naturally be the basis for all actions taken by an officer, for an officer could make use of anything except a tolerant point of view. Anything except a tolerant point of view. Meaning that when an officer is faced with a problem, a task, a necessity, he not only has the right to address this necessity, but the duty to eliminate all that stands in the way. Every officer will face this during the course of his leadership. Let me give you an example. Now, this is continuous. I didn't make any breaks in here. Let me give you an example. We have already eliminated one of your problems because we have many who say that they belong to such and such a sect, and that sect forbids us to kill. Now, he's talking about these people who say that, you know, they have personal beliefs that don't allow them to kill, or they belong to something, and so they can't, you know, they can't fight in the war. He says, we will become soldiers. These people say, we will become soldiers, but will refuse to kill. That used to be a problem an officer had to deal with. Based on his knowledge, he knew that life is an eternal struggle, and that he had to prepare those entrusted to him for this struggle. But now he faces a man who, based on honorable principles, tells him, I will not kill. I'll do anything else. Now the officer has to discuss this with that man. Now the most cowardly solution has been found. It was said that a man who refuses to fight is useless for our purpose. Therefore, we will not even recruit him. He doesn't exist. In other words, capitulation before a single subject to avoid addressing the issue. That is, just let's just say, well, we just leave these people alone. We won't draft them. We won't ask them to fight. We'll just, that's what you call avoiding a problem that you don't want to deal with. Hitler says, today the state takes care of this. His state, the National Socialist state. The state knows no such consideration. It is convinced that life is a struggle or a battle, an eternal battle, a principle each officer must accept as his own. Naturally, for he could never be an officer without it. A human unwilling to fight is unfit to live and must be eliminated. This is the part where the translator says that he's having a problem here. There seems to be words missing. Then goes on. This is Hitler. Nevertheless, even though those who, for ideological reasons, are unwilling to comply are kept out, an officer might find himself in that situation. That is, it can happen that a coward will start to poison others with his cowardice, and the officer is faced with the same question. One can sympathize, even understand, and say that he hasn't eaten for so long. We're talking about soldiers who, under the stress of battle, don't want to continue fighting. And Hitler's saying that you can sympathize that he hasn't eaten, or he's exhausted, he hasn't slept for a long time, and so on. But regardless of sympathy that you really feel, one must find the resolve to break that individual, if necessary, in the interest of the fighting forces, perhaps only the company or the battalion, to prevent the demise of the nation. That sounds really tough. I want to say here so that I don't forget at the end that, you know, it's not hard to think that this is not Hitler's real speech, because they're trying to make him sound like himself, but also very unbending in a way that would cause, you know, the general reaction from the ordinary public who would learn about it. So, you know, it's difficult. This, with so many of these things, I like the speech, but I'm not convinced for several reasons that it's accurate. And here's another thing, that all these people who just assume that it is, they don't even ask the questions. Veronica Clark puts out this book, says this is Hoff book, the Hoff speech, and that's it, you know. I imagine there are people who do question it, but I mean, the general run, haven't seemed to. And yet, the first thing that came to my mind was, where did this thing come from? And it was interesting to hear, what Wilf said, where it came from. It could be a big lie, even. Well, no, I don't think she would have written it, but she couldn't write anything like this. Anyway, continuing on, Hitler, this is especially so in your profession, the officer profession, where the awareness must be not only to the duty to train, but also, if necessary, to destroy those resisting to be trained. Nature is intolerant. Nature is most intolerant, if I use the term tolerant in its human meaning. She destroys everything not fit for life, period. Those unwilling or unable to defend themselves, she destroys, and we are only a speck of dust in nature. Man is but a small bacteria or bacillus on a planet as this. If he tries to act counter to those laws, he will not change the laws, but will end his existence. I don't know if this is direct. Yeah, I think this is still flowing along. I incorporated these principles into German politics. Nothing new. Communism did this a long time ago. But Christianity also adhered to those principles. I must point out, gentlemen, this is not an unchristian principle I stand for. Christianity has destroyed those who did not believe what they were supposed to, but not so quick and simple. We use a bullet, they use fire. Burned them, the Christians did, those who wouldn't convert. Therefore, this was a principle already accepted then. I think that's pretty strong. I realized that when trying to build a new strong German state, one has to secure those principles, not just inside, that it is not enough to use these new principles to educate others. One must also be willing to eliminate those that are opposing those views or are unwilling to accept them. If you will, that this is part of this ideology. I started all of this as an experiment in our own movement. That movement has been viewed as intolerant. But because of it, it has, after not quite 15 years, been victorious because it adhered to natural laws, even though it started under the most adverse conditions imaginable. At the head, a Führer, or a leader, unknown, poor, no press at his disposal, no big names endorsing him, no sympathies whatever, etc. But in spite of all this, that movement was victorious, evidence that a basic conviction is right and that the implementation of it was correct. Then I have something from further on. I want to say here that you know, in this speech, if this is a very long speech, this is just a small part of it that I thought was something I wanted to say that fit in with this program about the problem of nice. And you can see how it fits in, I guess. And so I copied this part out. But he is in a way without any pompousness and without any, you know, insecurity about it or without anything. He is telling this very large number, I understand, supposedly, that were here, of officers, generals, and on down to whatever rank they would be, really, you know, higher officers, probably mostly, why he has created the society he has, and why it's right, and why it's good, and why it's been successful. And this is 1944. And, of course, he is also telling them that they're going to be victorious, because they have to be. And they're all applauding, and sometimes it says they're applauding very vigorously. Well, naturally they would, because everybody recognized him as the leader, and the way of thinking was that the leader was the leader, and you followed the leader. You didn't question the leader. That's why those who did want to question were created these little plots, like what happened in August of 1944 with the Valkyrie assassination attempt. But he had to always be, how do I put that? He had to always be persuading and re-persuading his military, his officers, and so on, that what he was doing was the right thing to do. He couldn't just leave them go on, you know, and expect that they are never going to forget that, and they were going to do what he thought just through the ordinary channels. So this was obviously one of these times when he felt it necessary to get them together and give one of these talks. And it was like a talk. It wasn't a speech. It was like a talk, I think. Well, maybe if there was that many of them, it might have been, you know, in a big location. But these are just impressions that I have from it. Now, here's another part later on I thought was good. However, gentlemen, when I began my apprenticeship 25 years ago, this was not so. There I was always told by middle-class bourgeois circles, yes, people and race are one and the same. Hitler says, no, people and race are not the same. Race is a component of blood, a blood nucleus, but the people are very often composed not of one race, but of 2, 3, 4, or 5 different racial nuclei. Even so, it is not possible or even desirable to dismantle such a united body of people, but in the course of political development, such a solution may occur anyway. Well, then he goes on to talk about racial composition and how it influences what Germans are and do, and I'm not going to go into that, but it follows pretty much along things that he had said and things that were written by the and put out as official National Socialist policy and Third Reich policy and so on, the Germans being mixed races, a number of Aryan types. And even here's something I took down from this. That's not it. Well, he said that there was also this prehistoric German that was in the German blood, you know, in the German race mixture. Tan Stoffel has talked about that. And I was actually identifying with that more than anything else, that prehistoric German thing. But he thought very highly of it. He said it came from the Greeks, and it was in the Spartans. And so on. And I didn't think I needed to read all that, but it was pretty interesting. And he also said that all these various talents that Germans have, like commercial talent. No, that was the Jews. technical talent or something, but one of them was artistic, and it was visual artistic, and then another was musical. It seemed to me that it was the hearing more than vision. But he said here, now, in addition, other race nuclei contain a very artistic disposition with a purely optical talent, the ability to observe and depict. All right, see, I identify with that one. That's one of the abilities of within the German race. But, you know, this is... So then further on, I thought this was important. Our advantage is that we now have a well-organized society, and no outsiders can lecture us. Compare this to other states. We witnessed what happens when a state chooses to take the opposite direction, as Hungary did. This is probably around at the time that he went to, in 1944, I'm trying to remember the, I think it was in May or something. He was dealing with Hungary and trying to get them to give up their Jews. And he had talked to Horthy all of this. Anyway, so he's referring to this. He says Hungary took the wrong course. He said the whole state is decayed and corroded. Jews everywhere, right up to the highest position. Jews upon Jews. The whole of the state, one network of spies and agents who remained inactive because they were afraid that if they acted, we would get involved. But they were biding their time. I interfered here as well, and this problem will be solved also. And I have to say, Jews have made it their purpose to eliminate the German peoples. I explained this to the Reichstag, or the Parliament, on September 1st, 1939. Stating that if someone believes that the German nation will be eliminated through war, then he is mistaken. If Jewry thinks this, then Jewry will be eliminated. There was lively applause at that. Believe me, he says, the people are not able to decide that for themselves. This is a good part. Often I have been asked, well, why don't you let the people decide in this matter? I have always made the decisions and then asked the people, are you in agreement with this decision? But I never expected the people to make this decision. If the leadership is unable to muster the courage to make a decision, can I then expect the common people of my folk to make it? When the deep thinkers are unable to agree, then somebody has to make a decision. And that is what is beautiful about the officer profession. It is obvious, impossible to let the company decide, or the battalion, or even my subordinate officer, what decision has to be made. But one has to be made, and if it has to be made in a critical situation, then that officer can be proud to have made it, when he accepted the responsibility, knowing full well that at times he could be wrong. That is not important. There's applause at that. I hope you get I'm sure you understand the meaning of that. Better to be wrong than to allow the masses to have the conviction that they are in charge, that the decision rests with them. That would be synonymous with a declaration of abandonment of leadership, a declaration of cowardice. That must never happen. Well, that's all I took down there. Okay, I'm doing pretty good here. I think this sounds like Adolf Hitler, but then other things have been written that are fake that sound like Hitler, but people who have studied his other writings and so on can do that, you know, can copy it and make it sound quite a bit like him. So I don't know. I haven't done any deeper research, and I really don't know how to do it if there's nothing much there. There's a copy of this speech in a German history archive. But why hasn't it been published? If you can get it from there, that's what she says. But that's not what Wilf said. So, how I tie this in, I already have kind of with the problem with knives, is that I think we have, we're not able, most people are not able to, they might sit around like John Friend and promote Adolf Hitler's views. And he wrote that review on Amazon saying that this was such a profound book. It taught him so much, especially the Flatterhof speech. And then, but you know, he would never be able to recognize this kind of necessity for intolerance and forcing people to, or killing people, or, you know, eliminating people who are bad for the whole. It's for the whole group. You know, he could never do that. He's even crying and screaming that I got on the radio and talked nasty about him. And I didn't, you know, I called him a fat Jew, which I didn't even call him. And he's all, he got on that debate with Mike, Scott, and Andrew. No, Andrew wasn't in that debate. Mike and Scott. And they didn't let him do his thing the way he wanted to, and they wouldn't let him dominate that debate and read off all of his points, you know, and explain everything about his position to the listeners. What that was, that's not a debate, you know. And then he leaves early and goes home and starts writing this blog and about how despicable they are. He doesn't want anything more to do with them, and includes Andrew in it because he had written, he had said that John had his ass handed to him. And things like that. So, you know, and then he included me because by then I had done my program by the time he wrote that post. No, I don't know. I really don't know how that works anymore because, but somehow, maybe he didn't include me in there. He included me in the next one. No, I don't know. Anyway, he's, you know, he's crying and he acts like he's been so abused. And here's the other thing. I think I already said this, but I want to say it again. His attitude is that he is an innocent injured party. You know, he doesn't try to, he has never really, even with me, in those things with me, in those nasty emails that I sent him, he has not, okay, I got 60 seconds. Good, I'm getting my Skype message anyway. I still don't have a SkyCon page. So he doesn't feel that he should look at himself because he just brushes away everything that he's done that is suspicious and acts like he has a right to do that. And the problem is with you for being an unkind person. He's got all his little followers saying the same thing. And I think I hope that it will be the end of John Friend being taken seriously, at least in a movement that is of the type that I'm trying to talk, that I talk about here in the second half, and that Hitler led. John Friend has no concept of Hitler, and really, whoops, I need to look at my Skype page, and really doesn't know. Okay, music is on, ladies and gentlemen. I'm out of here.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.